Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri, inviting you to discover what research, projects and events are taking place at the University of Malta. I'm very pleased to have with me in the studio today on University Matters, Professor Arnold Cassola. Just a very few words, a very brief bio of Professor Cassola. He lectures in Maltese and comparative literature here at the University of Malta and is the author and editor of various books and academic papers, of course. He was a founder member of the Alternativa Democratica, the Green Party in Malta, and has held elective office and political posts in Malta and in Italy and at a European level. Professor Cassola was made Cavaliere della Repubblica Italiana in 2003 by the then Italian President of the Republic, Carlo Azeglio Ciampi. Welcome to University Matters, Professor Cassola.
Thanks to you, Cavaliere.
Today we're going to talk again about Giovan Francesco Buonamico, who lived between 1639 and 1680. And we have mentioned him before. When you recounted his Belgian adventure. He's interesting also because we've got some wonderful literary records of visits by foreigners to Malta, but not so many accounts of Maltese visiting countries overseas, and Buonamico is a notable exception to this. Tell us exactly who Giovan Francesco Buonamico was.
Yes, as you recall, we had this, we talked about him last year too, because that year, in 2012, I had published this book on Buonamico's travels to Belgium, and this time it's Buonamico's travels to Germany. We are lucky to have his memoirs, his handwritten, his manuscript memoirs of his travelling in Europe. He spent 8 years going around, so, I mean, quite extensive during the 17th century. And this book is being launched in these days, in October, because actually the launching date is on the 10th of October at the German Maltese Circle in Valletta, Christopher Street, at 7 p.m. There will be Judge Vanni Bonello speaking, and there should be the German ambassador speaking about that too, and also Dr. Bernard Michele from the Department of Maltese. And it's being launched in this period because the 3rd of October is the German Reunification Day. It's about 350 years since Buonamico went on his trip to Europe. And also, next year will be the 10th anniversary of Malta's joining the EU, with all the polemics surrounding, and even today, whether it was worth it or not, doing that. But it is a reality of life, and so it gives, there's this European dimension of Buonamico, who actually lived Europe by going through Italy, France, Germany, Holland, Switzerland, Belgium, Flanders. So he was Greece, Italy. He was really a man of a European man. Who anticipated his times. He maybe was also a man of the product of the Renaissance, a very knowledgeable man, or he was described as a knowledgeable man, a man who would be interested in everything, in a bit of everything. He would write about the Glossopietre. He's written about the Glossopietre, which are the stones of St. Paul's, which were believed to be medicinal, have medicinal effects, etc., which in reality today we know they're fossil shark teeth, but this was a big issue in the 17th, 18th century and so on. He wrote about medicine, he was a doctor, but he wrote poetry in Latin, he wrote poetry in French, he wrote poetry in Maltese. His the oldest poem in Maltese, apart from the Cantilena, is Buonamico's Meiugi Bilboato Zar, which we all studied at school when we were children. So he's a really heterogeneous, you know, person, interested in so many things, in fact he was described by a biographer, an 18th century biographer in Latin, in a commentarius, as an astronomus, astronomer, geographer, numographus, antiquarius, mechanicus, geometra, mathematicus, medicus, physicus, poeta, Etorato. I don't know what's left. He's done all the jobs. I think he's a typical example of what, of flexibility today. No, today we are all saying we have to be flexible in this modern world. We have to adapt ourselves to different areas, and we can see that he was from a doctor to a physician to draftsman, geometra, mechanical person. But he liked antiques. He was an astronomer. He was a geographer, and I think this reflects actually his personality. His travelling, his 8 years of travelling in Europe before he settled down again in Malta to become the doctor of the Order of St. John, which at that time was under the Grand Master Cotoner, and indeed his poetry, his literary works are mainly works that are, how would you call them, lauding the Grand Master a bit, they don't look very poetic. They don't sound very poetic to me, and a bit of bootlicking, I would say.
It was
on
the
his
done
part.
Thing at the, I suppose, at the time.
Oh, it's done today. That's the problem. But tutto il mondo è paese, you know. I mean, men and women don't change so much at the end, and we're living in a society. Some people need some others. Some are powerful, and some are. Bonamico must have been a powerful man in the sense he came from a well-to-do family to be able to do all this travelling.
And in fact, I was going to say, not only does he have all the sort of electrical connections in the right place, I mean, he was a bright guy, obviously, but he also had the advantage of being well off, as
I would say, spending 8 years in Europe, not just wandering around. He studied in Europe, he went to universities in Aix-en-Provence, he went to university in France, in Belgium, so in Germany too. So he was you know, mixing study and pleasure, I would say, and he described his travelling. So that's basically something about Bonamico.
He was obviously an adventurous type, and as you say, interested in a lot of things. The fact that he actually went to study abroad, which we have difficulty sometimes persuading our own students to go and study abroad today in 2013. At that time, it can't have been that easy to just go.
It can't have been easy, but it was the only way. Remember, we must keep in mind that in the 17th century, there was no university yet. The university, as a university, giving out university degrees, started off in 1756, right, more or less.
1769,
sorry. After the Jesuits were the Jesuit college was closed down. So there was no printing press in Malta. So even a writer could not publish books in Malta. At least the only period they could do it was between 1643 and 1656. And then it closed down again until about 1759 or around that area, because of the quarrels and quibbles between who should give the imprimatur. Whether the Grand Master said, I am the political chief, yeah? Or the bishop says, no, I'm the religious chief, yeah? Or the inquisitor said, well, I'm sent here by the Pope. So the three of them fought, and for 200 years, basically, we stayed without, had to stay without a printing press. So any man of culture or woman of culture had to go abroad to study whatever profession you wanted to have, and also to publish your books, etc., and whatnot.
Do you have to do it whether you liked it, whether you liked it or not, if you had any ambitions?
To advance in life.
So, yes. So. Bonamico found himself, or decided to go on this adventure, which was I hesitate to call it a holiday because it doesn't sound much like a holiday, really.
Holiday.
Yes.
No, he worked. He actually studied. He actually got his degrees.
But when he went to Germany on this trip, first he went to Paris.
Yes.
He got on a horse and travelled in a carriage, right?
Yes, this was different, for example, very much from the Belgian trip. The Belgian trip, you would notice, he travelled a lot along the canals. He travelled in boats. Boats which were dragged by horses on land, you know, very narrow canals,
barges,
and he would these barges, and he would describe this, and he would get on a horse. Then, here in Germany, we don't have obviously the canals, so it's mainly travelling in carriages or on horseback, and stopping in various countries. As he said, he started off with Aachen, which is Aquisgrana, and which is the central place for Charlemagne, and you can see Charlemagne becoming one of the central figures of Bonamico in Germany, as Emperor Charles V had been the central figure in his Belgian memoirs, because Charles V had been born in Ghent, Josephus is the chap, it's the emperor who gave Malta to the Knights of Saint John. So there's the link also about these interests, no? And Charlemagne is the Holy Roman Emperor. And we can see from his writing that he's very much attached, Bonamico is very much attached to the Roman, to antiquity, to classical Rome. Julius Caesar is always quoted or mentioned in some way or another, and other various Roman personalities. But also he was a holy Roman Empire, Charlemagne. So and Bonamico is quite attached to the Catholic religion, to the Jesuits. He's always mentioning, pointing out any Jesuit building he finds it all over Europe. Saint Gilafi does not compare it to the Jesuit church in Malta, but compares it to other Jesuit churches in Naples, in Palermo. But he's always got this point of reference to other Jesuits, and of course the Catholic Church. And what does stick out in this this German, let's say, itinerary, is his his account of Germany, a divided Germany. Well, of course, Germany was not yet Germany.
It's in the about. Germany we know now, of
exactly.
course.
Exactly. It's the city-states. But it is divided, of course, politically. After the 30 Years' War, we had all the fighting and between the various city-states.
It hadn't long been finished.
No, it was just a few years later. But the result of this was also the difference between the different various towns and cities, the religious difference. I mean, Martin Luther had brought about the Reformation, then we had the Counter-Reformation. So he has a good account also of the specificity, the religious specificity of each of the towns he visits.
This comes across quite strongly, and it really is. It's interesting to see. You know, he'll go to Heidelberg, or
Koblenz, Mainz, Jülich, so many different places.
And he describes exactly what the religion of the population, and whether they were mixed Lutherans or Calvinists or Catholics. And it's interesting to see how there were cities which were totally Protestant and cities which were totally...
Yes, and there were cities which tolerated the other religions and cities which actually did not. So so you can see that when he starts, first of all, he has a strong bias against anybody non-Catholic. And this you can see from his adjectives, l'eretico, gli eretici would be the Protestants, le sette, the sects, apostati, Luther is the guy as the apostate, again eretici, etc. So esiliati per l'eresia. So for him, you can see from his point of view, there's no doubt that the Protestant religion is not acceptable. But his description, he gives us the different types of Protestants. For example, when he's commenting on the fact that we had the Lutherans, but he distinguishes the Lutherans from the Calvinists and from the Anabaptists. So
he seems to have understood very clearly what their issues were.
What their issues were, and also what they were doing. For example, when he is in Worms, in the city of Worms, which he portrays as a town inhabited mainly by Lutherans and governed by leaders of the same creed. And he tells us, for example, again in Frankenthal, we have it is mainly inhabited by Flemish people exiled because of the heresy. But I would say the apex of his intolerance towards non-Catholics is reached in Mannheim. Here, the ruling prince had transformed the city into a safe haven for people of different nationalities and creeds. I mean, it's the ideal place of acceptance, you know, the acceptance of diversity. So Mannheim was, a potpourri where people live together in Mannheim, and Bonamico says, una centina d'ogni setta d'eretici. Of course, his memoirs are written in Italian. I'm quoting in Italian because he says that. So, not content with describing the Protestants in Mannheim as eretici, Buonamico goes on to compare the city to Noah's Ark, with, you know, this, not only because it had this cacophony of ogni sorta di voci, because you had people from different walks of lives and different hues and colours, but also because it contained, he says, ogni specie di più sozzi animali. Even this thing of comparing, you know, human beings, okay, of different religions, but to sozzi, to different specie, okay, different species, that I can, but sozzi animali, of dirty animals, I wouldn't say that is to be taken as a compliment, you know?
Hardly.
What was interesting, for example, in Köln, which today is well known for being a Catholic, strong Catholic city of Germany, at his time it was governed by a Catholic, inhabited mainly by Catholics. On the other hand, Heidelberg was ruled by a Calvinist, and the population was all Calvinist. So, and he observes that at the university, in this university town, I mean, Heidelberg is a university town, famous today also, Lutherans were tolerated, but Catholics were absolutely not. So, he says, il principe e il popolo sono tutti calvinisti. So Calvinists tolerated, visitò anche qualche luterani. Ma nessun cattolico, but no Catholics, so it was out of bounds for Catholics. So, I could say that we didn't have a high opinion of Protestants in general, with regards. So it's interesting to see these towns, because you have this the result of the wars, which were religious wars too, and therefore also the toponymy, the geographical distribution of the various say religious denominations in Germany.
I'm joined in the Campus FM studio for University Matters by Professor Arnold Cassola to talk about his new publication on Giovan Francesco Buonamico. He went to Aachen. As you pointed out, it was a sort of special place for him, so probably it's not by chance that he first went to Aachen. And then he seems
also
to...
Also, because obviously it's on the way from Belgium. He's travelling, coming in Paris, you know, it's one of the nearest places, but I think he had that in mind. He wanted to go to certain
places. Wanted to see it himself.
Yes, yes.
Then he sort of moved up the Rhine towards Switzerland,
yes.
If I understood rightly.
He followed the Rhine, basically, mm-hmm. one way. Goes down from Aachen. He passes through the towns of Jülich, small towns, Düren and Koblenz. Jülich is today known as, in French it was known as, he calls it Juliers, which is French Julier. And of course, he says it's a small city, piccola e poco abitata, but it was Jülich, founded by Julius Caesar, so it goes back to his origin, it was named Juliacum. He's also interested in the etymology of the names of cities and so on. I'm working on him as a linguist too. He was always trying to go back to the etymology of words, and sometimes kind of his theories, which might be right or sometimes are wrong, etc. Then he passed through Düren, which then had the religious aspect. For example, Düren housed the relics of Saint Anne, which he specifies as being her capo, so the head of Saint Anne, is where in Jülich. Actually, these were the relics that had been stolen from Mainz, from the Saint Stefan Church in Mainz in 1501, but in 1506 Pope Julius had decreed that they could remain in Düren. That's a place he went to. Koblenz then, which is again the second largest city in Trier, in the Principality of Trier, she describes as a very pleasant city, amenissima città, and that's where the Rhine and the Mosel get together. We're talking here about the wine producing area, Rhine, Mosel, and of course he goes on to the notable sites, so he mentions Hermestein, which is a castle perched upon a hill dominating the waters. But of course he also goes on to the Winer. I think he was a man also who enjoyed life in a way.
Certainly seems to have been interested in sort of the wines and the spirits. We visited his love of beer in Belgium,
because he had also discovered beer and hops and growing. He had never seen it before. He was young. He's in his 20s when he's doing this travelling, right? So we also remember that him travelling first class on one of these barges, you know, for 2 days, and in the company of the Belle Signore. He enjoyed the talk.
Sure he did.
With a glass of beer there. Here he's very much into wine, and mentions a lot the wine producing areas.
I know, I'm just going to say, I remember going to Germany for the first time, and in my ignorance I imagined that it was sort of just a beer drinking country. And I was flabbergasted to discover absolutely superb German wines, which are a bit of a secret, really. They're not exported with quite the same vehemence as the Italian and French ones are.
Well, the German wines are good, very good wines, done in a different way. Obviously, because of the climate in Germany, you're allowed to add sugar to wine to increase the alcohol content, while that's supposed to be illegal in Italy. And in France, it depends. I mean,
they're not all sweet wines. I imagine they're all sweet, but adding sugar doesn't mean that they end up sweet wines.
Adding sugar is just to increase the alcohol content, not to sweeten the wines and so on. And so we would see, for example, moving on his way, he passes through the Rhine, for example, and in the Köln region, on the left bank of the Rhine, he says, "Cove numerose vigne, di cui verdeggiano tutte le colline d'intorno." All the hills around are all full of vines. He lists Koblenz and Glever and small villages in Hassia, like Bingen, Brahna, all renowned for the bounty of their wine produce. Luoghi rinomati per l'esquisitezza dei loro vini. The city of Worms is described as being sited on a vast green plain full of vines, verdeggiante d'ogni intorno per la quantità di vigne che la circondano. It was an exceptionally fertile area, obviously, and another fertile area which he also describes is the region of Alsace. Today, part of it is in France, obviously, Strasbourg and so on. But in particular, coming from the direction of Spire, and also the hills surrounding Heidelberg. According to Mon Amico, these hills, which border the Neckar River, produce the most exquisite wines in Germany, and he said that they were as good as any wine that could be produced in France. And finally, he also gives a little note on an eau de vie, a sort of grappa or whatever, which was different. He says this in Worms they produced so much grain that they didn't know what to do with it. So eventually they started to soak the grain in water, distilled it various times in copper alembics, and then this eau de vie was produced. But the initial product had, he says, quite an aftertaste of burnt alcohol. So what happened was that this product, this eau de vie, was sent to Holland, which was sweetened with sugar and other flavors, and then exported to other countries in Europe, the Americas, and the East India too. So he's observing quite a lot of things here.
Absolutely. Going back to the saints for a moment, he's very interested in the saints when he goes into the towns, and he discovers the churches. And
especially, yes.
I was interested to see also that he does talk about myths, and where he thinks that they are just myths, stories. He does actually say so, and I think that is certainly a feather in his cap, that he was prepared to say, listen, you know, this is just a myth, it can't possibly have been like that, and even though he sort of loved these saints and liked to talk about them.
Yes, he's a number of saints.
He was an intellectual and a good one.
He mentions, as I said, we already saw Saint Anne's Skull in the city of Duren. He mentions Saint Bernard, who had knelt in the sumptuous Spire Cathedral, all things that he had visited. Then in the city of Köln, he mentions two saints. The first is Saint Ursula, the British Virgin, who was subjected to a cruel death in Köln. At the hands of the Huns, the invading pagan Huns, because she, together with thousands, it would say, of maidens, refused to give up their religious beliefs and virginity. He visited the monastery of dedicated to Saint Ursula, and then he also visited the Dominican Sankt Andreas Dominikanenkirche, the Dominican Church, Saint Andreas Church in Köln, where Albert the Great's tomb is to be found. He also mentions this Archbishop of Reims, Turpin, who was considered for many years the author of the life, Historia de Gesta of Carlo Magno and Roland and so on. So part of the Charlemagne...
That would have interested him, definitely.
Middle Ages, chanson de geste, which we study as part of our beginning of European literature, was written by Turpin, and he mentions the legend concerning Turpin and Charlemagne and the nun who had cast a spell on Charlemagne, so much so that and this is what you were referring to. He says this is una registrata nel romanzo piuttosto che storia, that this is more of a legend rather than a real history, it's a mythical fable. And where Charlemagne had actually fallen in love with this nun, she had cast a spell on him, and even when she died, he wouldn't have her with him all the time. So, and this Turpin managed to break the spell and so on. But he himself says that this is more of a fable than a real thing.
He also went a bit in search of his fellow doctors, didn't he?
Yes.
He liked sort of finding out whether there were any notable medics in the places that he visited.
Yes, as usual, wherever he went, especially in university towns, we saw that even in Louvain and Leuven in Belgium, he looks out and mentions doctors who had graduated, and of course, being a doctor himself, he could not ignore the fact. Here, in Heidelberg, he mentions the doctor Heinrich Smet, who was a Flemish physician and a humanist, who was a professor at the said university. He was the founder of the botanical gardens of Heidelberg. And then a certain Largio, who unfortunately I have not been able to identify or to trace. A Largio who graduated in Heidelberg as a doctor. So if any listener might have some news, he can contact me, and he can also come on the 10th of October at 7 p.m. at the German Maltese Circle for the talk, which is open to the public.
Well, thank you very, very much, Professor Arnold
Cassola,
for coming on University Matters to talk to us about the traveller Buonamico. Thank you. Thank you for listening to University Matters on Campus FM. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.